This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with State Senator Ben Nevers. He has some thoughts about Medicaid expansion, or the lack thereof, as the issue continues to permeate at the Capitol regarding the governor's decision to decline the federal Medicaid money. Also on the show, we will talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Jeffrey Marks. He is in Baton Rouge, where he now lives as a champion of organ donation. This comes after the death of his sister, Wendy, who fought for 14 years after getting a liver transplant, and his good buddy, the 9-time gold medalist, Carl Lewis, is slated to be with us as well. Carl Lewis is in Baton Rouge as well. He'll be throwing out the first pitch at an LSU baseball game, and he'll be talking with us this hour. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside our area, it is 877-217-5757. We're talking to begin our show with State Senator Ben Nevers, Democrat from Bogalusa, albeit a conservative Democrat, and he is here to talk about a few items at the Capitol as the lawmakers complete another week heading to the finish line in just over a month, as there is still much work to be done. Good morning, Senator Nevers.
Good morning, Jim.
What is
good
your?
To be with you.
It's great to hear your voice. What is the situation now regarding Medicaid expansion?
Well, Jim, as you know, I'm not a fan of unfunded mandates in our state. As a matter of fact, I have a bill in the legislature that prohibits unfunded mandates. But as I looked at, the Medicare issue and looked at, the maybe a possible solution for us to basically a Washington, D.C. mandate. Some people know it as Obamacare. I thought, as I watched this issue and certainly weighed on my conscience and mind about 290,000 to 420,000 Louisianans who are uninsured, what can we do about it? And, of course, certainly if you're uninsured and your family's uninsured, how vulnerable you are, and in many cases, the only option for you or your family is to go to the emergency room. I've started looking for some solution to the problem, and as I watched other states deal with the Affordable Care Act, I began to see plans emerging that was led by Republicans and Democrats, but I was especially intrigued by a plan that was being developed in Arkansas by a group of Republicans. A small group started this, and they were Republicans, and they began to develop a plan. And, then I saw a Democratic governor of Arkansas get on board with it and other Democrats. And they basically, as you know, passed this piece of legislation out of the Arkansas legislature by over 75% in both the House and the Senate. So I said, well, there is hope for us to really create a plan in Louisiana that's a Louisiana plan, not someone else's plan, but a plan that would allow us to provide health care to these people. So I developed a set of amendments that will provide a Louisiana solution to a Washington, D.C. mandate. And what Senate Bill 125 does in its current form is it outlines a Louisiana solution to deal with the 290,000 to 420,000 uninsured citizens in Louisiana. The program outlined in the bill would be named Louisiana Healthcare Independence Program. And I think independence is a big word, and it's one we shouldn't take lightly. I think we've fought wars, and we've fought many, many battles about the independence of our people, and especially in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. So what this would do, it'd create a health insurance marketplace. The marketplace would help individuals and families and small businesses shop for and select the best possible health care coverages in a way that permits comparison of available qualified health plans based upon price, benefits, and services, and of course, quality. And of course, these plans would be offered by private insurance companies, and no one would be mandated to purchase them. I think that's a huge issue. We give our people the choice, but we also give them the choice to be insured.
All right. Well, where does Senate Bill 125 stand at this point?
Well, it stands, it will be referred to finance this week. And certainly it's an issue that that I would hope that Louisiana citizens would get involved in and begin to communicate with their legislators. So, again, I say that it's a Louisiana solution to a federal mandate, and I think that it's the only responsible thing that we can do.
Governor Jindal has said he won't go along with Medicaid expansion. Would he, in your judgment, would he go along with this version of it?
Well, certainly, I don't know. I've heard that he said that he's not for any plan to expand Medicaid. But I tell you, Jim, I truly believe that I couldn't sleep at night if I turned my back on, you know, over 300,000 Louisiana citizens. The fact are we can insure these citizens and be reimbursed 100% by the federal government. That's not to say that we won't have some cost associated with Medicaid expansion, but the savings will far outweigh any cost associated with it, Jim.
297-5633 for Senator Ben Nevers, Democrat from Bogalusa, who is filing Senate Bill 125. Late in the game, he's trying to get some kind of compromise brokered. House Speaker Chuck Cleckley has also said Medicaid expansion for 2013 is dead on arrival. Have you talked with him at all?
I haven't talked to Speaker Cleckley, but let me say this is not a bill that I filed. It's an amendment I put on a bill that's sponsored by Karen Carter Peterson. But it basically turned her bill into, a private insurance piece of legislation that I believe provides a Louisiana solution.
So it's germane to the topic.
That's correct.
Well, as you noted, it happened in Arkansas, and it was a Republican legislature that did this. And in Arkansas, unlike Louisiana, there's a Democratic governor who embraced it. It would seem that Governor Jindal ultimately will be the determining factor in this. How can you get a read on whether or not he's amenable to changing his mind?
Well, let me say this. I've worked with Governor Jindal over the past 5 years, and I believe he will be responsive to the people in our state. So I would hope that our people would contact him, and certainly I've saw him change his position in the past. So I believe once he understands that this is what the people want and this is what possibly the legislature would want, that he hopefully will reconsider his position. But I say this, if we do not expand Medicaid, many of our businesses are going to be subjected to what they call a shared responsibility payment. And, as I look at some of the reports, I see that number, certainly could impact our businesses tremendously. One report that I looked at says that, it will cost Louisiana businesses $51 million to $77 million penalties that they will be charged. So I can say there's numerous parts of this that can have a huge negative effect on Louisiana if we don't expand. And I assure you the amendment that I placed on the bill has tremendous protection built into it. One of the provisions is that it terminates in 2017. So, what I've tried to do is craft an amendment that assures the people we're not going to get stuck with a bill from the federal government, or we're not going to have to take additional tax money out of our citizens' pocket and pay for this plan, and we have the right to terminate it at any time. So those protections are built into it, as well as statements that say this is not an entitlement program. And they have to, individuals that participate would have to sign off that they understand this is not an entitlement program, that it's a program that could be terminated at any time if the federal government reneges on its bargain to pay certain percentages. So that's really what the bill does in its current form. I would hope that the people in Louisiana would look at it, Senate Bill 125, and hopefully respond to their legislators and the governor's office and let us hear from you.
Other than the early termination, what is the biggest distinction between your amendment, Senator Peterson's bill, and the provision spelled out in Obamacare?
Well, I think it allows the private insurance market to enter into this equation. And as I said, we do not mandate that any citizen in Louisiana purchase insurance, but it gives them an option to buy affordable health care, and it also allowed for premium assistance But based upon income, it would require a copay from our citizens, which is a buy-in into the program. So I just truly believe that it is a solution, and certainly we could monitor it over the next 3 years, and if it becomes something that we don't feel is good for our citizens, we'd terminate it.
Jim on Highland Road. Jim, good morning. Please turn down your radio. Jim, you're on the air with Senator Ben Nevers. Hi, Jim.
Senator.
Good morning, Jim.
I would like to ask you, why has all the health care been so unthought of to the last minute with the closing of Earl K. Long, the fact that the Bogalusa Hospital is going to be leased out after having a med school there, and that y'all are maybe reduced to minimum beds, and if they're talking about doing it with the lake, if they do it with the lake, it means no childbirth, which you just opened a new OBGYN unit there, along with your medical school expansion.
Yeah, so well, let me say, Jim, I'm very disappointed, especially in the hospital that have been doing very well, that they're being forced into a public-private partnership. But again, as you know, as state senator represents two LSU hospitals, I have to do what's best for the citizens in my district. And it seemed as though it was one hospital was scheduled to go to a 10-bed unit, which was Bogalusa, and the other one was scheduled to do the same, which was Lolly Kemp. And of course, I fought for, you know, every opportunity to allow them to remain in the LSU system, but unfortunately, that's not going to happen, it doesn't look like.
Now, back in February 25th, the Obama administration said that states could cut Medicaid payments to many doctors and other health care providers to hold down costs in the program. It ensures 60 million low-income people, and that includes 400,000 projected in Louisiana. Do you have a firm handle on the actual number? I've seen numbers north of 400,000 and some less than that. Do you know?
Jim, numbers are, you know, everywhere, and we're trying to get a firm number on Senate Bill 125 as it's been amended. But I can tell you, if we don't expand Medicaid in this state, you're going to have many hospitals in this state close. It's that simple. Rural hospitals across this state are really on the borderline of going bankrupt today. And to not allow them to, you know, be able to receive additional incomes and the billions of dollars that will flow into Louisiana that will create tremendous amounts of jobs in the medical care community and provide an opportunity for people to be healthier and more productive to our businesses, in my opinion, is just not the right thing to do. I think we have to find some means to do this.
Well, it's a situation in which the governor has drawn the proverbial line in the sand, and is anybody communicating with him as far as this potential compromise? If you're not, who is?
Well, certainly we're communicating with the administration. I haven't spoken directly with the governor, but I've asked him to consider these proposals as well as some others that I have. And we're going to work through the system that we have. I will meet with the governor at any time to discuss these options. And again, I believe that the people of Louisiana should decide. And I believe that they need to get involved in this issue. They need to communicate with the legislators and the governor and tell them how they feel. But if there's no cost associated with this for 3 years and it's a savings to the state, it makes no sense not to insure these 300,000+ people.
Well, the question posed by one listener is what happens, and we've discussed this before, when somebody who's not covered goes to the emergency room at one of these hospitals, they're not going to be denied treatment, are they?
No, sir. They would have to be seen. And let me say, I represent a district that's very diverse, and I have a lot of people that are stricken with poverty, a lot by no choice of their own. And I can tell you, if they're sick, their family members sick, their children sick, what they do is they can't get an appointment with a doctor. They have no way to pay for it. They go to the emergency room.
All right, 297-5633. A few more minutes with Senator Ben Nevers, and then we'll hear from Carl Lewis and Jeffrey Marks. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside our area, 877-217-5757. In just a few moments, we'll hear from Jeffrey Marks, Pulitzer Prize-winning sports writer, and Carl Lewis, the great Olympian who is in our community for something very special. Senator Ben Nevers, Democrat, Bogalusa, with us for just a bit longer. And as we were going to the break, you were talking about people who would not have insurance if this Medicaid expansion is rejected. They go to the emergency room. Who picks up the tab for this, Senator?
Well, as you know, we do. The taxpayers do. And, of course, the health care you receive in the emergency room is the highest cost that can possibly be given in our state. So, once again, I say that I believe there's substantial savings to the state by providing a Louisiana solution to a federal mandate. Now, let me say this, to not allow these 300,000-plus people to be insured, I basically think that we sentence them to a situation that continues to provide an unhealthy life for them. And in some cases, we sentence them to death, Jim, because they can't get the preventive care they need, and it's at the emergency room that is determined that they got stage 4 cancer. So I think that it's unconscionable not to look at some way to insure these people.
So your bill is heard next week, at least that's the plan.
Well, we hope that finance will schedule the bill next week and hear it in Senate Finance, and of course if it comes out of finance, it would go to the full Senate.
Then you got to deal with the House.
That's correct. There are some bills in the House, I might say, that I understand will be heard Wednesday in committee that possibly might be amended to look like this bill. So there's some opportunities on both sides of the aisle and both sides of the legislature.
Are you working with any representatives on the House side?
I'm working with anyone that will listen. And as I've said, this is not a partisan issue. It's not about Republican, Democrat. It's about insuring 300,000-plus people in Louisiana.
And what do you think your chances are?
Well, certainly I think legislators understand, I guess, the position we place these people in if we don't at least make an effort to do something. Now, the governor ultimately will make a decision, but I think the legislature needs to at least send a message that we're interested in a plan of this type. And without doing that, I think we haven't done our job, Jim.
297-5633, Inkster Show at WRKF.org as we wrap up with Senator Ben Nevers. And we certainly have followed this Medicaid issue from the start. Does it surprise you that Governor Jindal has not done as many other Republican governors around the country have done and changed his mind and changed course on this issue?
Well, I don't know that he's heard from the people yet, but as I looked at what, you know, Governor Rick Scott from Florida said, I mean, a quote from him was, "While the federal government is committed to pay 100% of the cost, I cannot in good conscience deny Floridians the needed access to health care." And, of course, Scott said hastily in a news conference at the governor's mansion that he did propose Medicaid expansion, at least for the initial period. It only makes good sense. So, I mean, there's a Republican governor that, as you know, was totally opposed to Obamacare. And as I said, this is not about whether we oppose Obamacare or not. As I just said to you, I'm against federal or state mandates. But the facts are, this is a Louisiana solution we're proposing to a federal mandate.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Good morning, Phil. You're on the air with Senator Nevers.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Senator. My question is this. What does it take to override the governor's veto? And I don't know, has that ever happened? What would it take to get it past the governor? Or would it come up again in another session in 2014?
Well, certainly you can override a veto by 2/3 vote of the House and the Senate. But let me say this. I would hope that we wouldn't come to that. I would hope that we can work with the governor and other stakeholders and provide some plan for the people in this state. But I assure you, this issue is not going away. It will come before every session of the legislature we have until we find some way to help these people.
Now, the governor, I'm told, is stating that it really doesn't matter what the legislature does. He's got the authority to do what he wishes on this, that he trumps the legislature on this particular issue. Have you heard that?
Well, I certainly have heard that, and let me say this. He certainly controls many things in this state, but I also believe that he will respond to the people. If the people will give them their true feelings, I believe that he will respond. I have to believe that. I mean, he's been elected twice, and certainly I would hope that we would all put politics aside and begin to, you know, talk about what's good for our people.
Well, in a luncheon meeting with Republican senators, the governor earlier this week apparently told them he wouldn't sign off on expansion of Medicaid, even if a bill that calls for the coverage passes the legislature. And he said, according to, I'm quoting a story that John McGinnis reported, "I'll take the heat." So he's laying down the gauntlet on this one, Senator. You want people to contact their senators and representatives, and certainly that's a part of the process, and I would encourage people on either side to do this. What's the best way to do that?
Well, certainly it's very important that the citizens of Louisiana contact their local representative and senator, because they know them the best. But I would also ask them to contact the governor's office, so that at least the governor's office knows that how the citizens feel across our state. And I, you know, once again, I have tremendous faith in the people of this state, and I believe that any of us that are trying to do what the people would want us to do should listen, and we should at least consider that position. And so I'm hoping that the governor will do the same.
Well, we thank you, Senator Ben Nevers. Good to talk with you.
Thank you, Jim.
Take care, my friend.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye. And I do want to note, I got an email at 5 o'clock this morning from Jim Mayer stating that Jerry Lane, the well-known car dealer in this community, many years a successful business person in Baton Rouge, died this morning after a long battle with cancer. And he was a guest on this show just a few weeks ago. But we wish Jerry's family well, and his employees and all the friends that he's had over the years. We wish them well, and we mourn their loss. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, 877-217-5757. And it's extremely rare when we have a 9-time gold medalist in the studio. We've talked to Carl Lewis through the years telephonically, but he is here with his good friend Jeffrey Marks, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who calls this community home. And they're here to talk about a few things, and one of them is organ donation. And as we get to that topic, how did the two of you meet, Carl?
Jeff and I met working on a project back in the late 80s. It's really interesting. Who would have thought that just putting two people together from different parts of the world to work on a project would create a friendship and relationship that would last this long? Longer since, it seems like, than before.
Yeah. And you came here, has it been 2 years? It's been, I remember
2 years ago, Carl was here.
And Jeff had a special night in which the two of them talked in front of several hundred of their closest friends. And it was quite an experience hearing more about Carl Lewis. And at that time, I think you had just almost entered the political fray.
Yeah, exactly. So I was sitting here listening to the senator, so that was kind of an interesting thing. And then I was also 49, getting ready to turn 50, so I had a real busy year going on.
Yeah. Well, the two of you are close in age and have a lot in common, and Jeffrey is a man who's covered many of the world's great athletes. It started with you early in life as far as your exposure to world-class athletes, and one of those who made a big impression on you is a guy played down the street at Louisiana State University, Bertram Hayes Jones.
Bertram Hayes Jones, when Bert was a quarterback for the Baltimore Colts back in the early 1970s, I was fortunate enough to be a little 11-year-old kid running around with a big head of hair and a lot of fun in my life, because I was a ball boy for the Colts during a lot of those years that Bert was there as a quarterback. So I had amazing experiences, not only to grow up as a kid working and living with and traveling with a professional football team, but also learning about this place called Louisiana and specifically LSU from a colorful character named Burt Jones. So that was a lot of fun.
And Carl, when he was at the University of Houston at LSU in 1981, when he was all of 19 years old, that's when you made your big national splash, right?
That was my big splash. Yeah, that was a big year for me. I set a world record indoors in the long jump. And then I tried for the first time outdoors the 100 meters and long jump. That was the first event, major event I ever tried the double and was able to win it here at LSU, the 100 meters and the long jump. And that was kind of the beginning of the real, real big splash, like you said, in my life. Because once I completed that, they started talking to Jesse Owens comparisons. And I hadn't thought of it in that context, but it started here.
Well, you were 19 then. You're 51 now. July 1, 1961, you were born a month and 3 days before the President of the United States. I'm sure as a young man growing up, you probably doubted that there would ever be a black man who's president of the United States, and here we have one, and he is almost the same age as you. Do you feel a kinship with President Obama?
Oh, no question. I mean, it is interesting, the stories of going through where he went around the world, and he was able to experience that, and my parents were really heavily involved in the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s in Alabama, I was raised that way. So I understand the context of how his parents were so strong, or his mother rather, especially, and driven, because they drove him to be the best that he can be. And that's kind of the way I felt. And to think about that and to see him when he started running, and then just to see the pride in my mother and how happy she was. And sometimes I've got to protect her because she's like, oh, they're just trying to get him. Mother, it's okay. He's the president, or he won. So it's okay. He crossed the finish line.
Well, I don't think he would have been elected president had there not been African-American athletes who had been accepted by white America through the years, people like Jesse Owens and Joe Louis and Muhammad Ali and Carl Lewis. So in many ways, black athletes have had an impact on society that goes well beyond the arenas in which you performed.
That's such an important point to make, because I understand when I came in and they started comparing me to Jesse, and they say, oh, well, you're different. You said, you're exactly right, I'm different. Fortunately, because of Jesse, I was able to go up in the real elevator, not the service elevator. And they made a sacrifice for the future, knowing that they would not benefit at that moment. And I think a lot of young athletes have to even understand that now. You really have to put yourself into context, whether we like it or not. Sports is politics. It's always been political. The Olympics has always been political. So you have to understand you're here at a certain period of time, and you can affect the world in a way that other people cannot. Why are you chosen to do that? The sacrifice always comes back to benefit you. And I had a tough time in my career because I wanted to try to make it better and change, not because I was this visionary, because that's the way I was raised. And I admired people that made that difference. But now I get the benefits. I'm in my 50s now, and people remember the great things that we tried to do. They remember the fact that we can talk about organ donation, and they actually want to listen, or professionalism that we tried to change, or fighting drugs. Mm-hmm. That's what people remember. They don't remember the other stories.
We're going to talk about organ donation in a few minutes, and that's the reason that Carl is here, and it involves Jeffrey and his experience with his beautiful sister, Wendy. But Jeffrey is noted as a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist in his own right, and since we're talking about sports and politics, I remember Howard Cosell used to accuse sports writers of having dugout vision. They only want to report on the games and not anything beyond what we see. That's changed.
Oh, it really has, and for me, I've been incredibly fortunate, and I've also enjoyed so much using that world of sports as a writer in ways that really have nothing to do with the games themselves. I've always been a huge believer in the sports platform being the most powerful platform in America that we have today, not just for scores and for records and for league championships, but for using that platform in ways to touch people's lives in positive fashion. And that's why working with someone like Carl has been so amazing through the years. Association with some of the folks here at LSU that care so deeply about those same types of messages. And honestly, that's what I've enjoyed the most about it. You know, Cosell was an interesting guy. Mm-hmm. A lot of young people don't really remember who he was, but it was really neat as a young journalist. I did have a chance to interact with him at times in different places. And I was both amused by him and also learned from his approach as well.
What do you think of all the attention this week, Jeffrey, regarding Jason Collins and his announcement?
It's interesting. I haven't followed it real closely. I've just seen some of the stories like everyone else has, and I think it's a wonderful place for, just like with any important social issue, once again, using that that sports platform to be able to reach people and learn new things. There's something about sports that makes issues more accessible to the general public because we love sports. In a lot of cases, we feel like we know our athletes and coaches a lot better than we really do. And so whenever we have an opportunity to use that platform in a way to learn something new and to share something important as a culture, I think that's a wonderful thing.
You have become immersed in LSU sports, obviously, living in this community now for several years.
I have. I really love LSU sports. It's been a fun thing for me coming here, having grown up in New York, went to school in Chicago, spent most of my adult years in Washington, D.C. This is, of course, a new place for me. It's not that new anymore. I've been here almost 7 years now, and my wife being from Thibodaux, that's why I came here. And LSU sports has been a wonderful way for me to learn about the community and to meet so many people and build a lot of great relationships.
Well, this community has a ways to go in some areas, and I've noted on this show that there are more African-Americans on the LSU football team than there are African-American professors at the university. 52 African-American professors on a campus with over 30,000 students. And yesterday it was announced the Reveille, the campus newspaper, won essentially the national championship of college newspapers, named Best in America by the Society of Professional Journalists. I doubt that there'll be a banner flying over Tiger Stadium for that.
Wow. Well, first of all, thank you, because this happens every time I visit with you. I've now learned two new things this morning. Yeah. I didn't know either of those points, so that's great about the newspaper. It's not as great about the numbers you brought up in terms of the professors. That's interesting. I had no idea about that.
And Carl, you've lived in various places in this country. Mm-hmm. You've been all over the world. What kind of experience do you get in the South, in your what amounts to your home area, where you were born, where you went to college, as opposed to other places in the United States and around the world?
Well, it's really interesting because my parents were both teachers. So education was very important. They both went to Tuskegee Institute. So my mother says, don't call it university. And they both went to Tuskegee. So I, being in a family that transcended race, and that was their idea to stand up and do what you think is right. They were involved in civil rights. The community I grew up in was basically started off as an all-white community. And then we were one of the first families to move in. And then when I finally grew up in New Jersey, it was. It felt like everyone was normal, and that came because of the power of education and opportunity. Most of the parents were college graduates; they were working or military. So I was able to see that in order to try to get equality or feel that way, you really have to work hard at getting your acceptance through yourself.
297-5633. We'll take a 90-second pause and return with Jeffrey Marks and Carl Lewis. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. And two fascinating gentlemen. We could talk with them about various topics for several hours, and we're going to hit as many as we can in our remaining time, and we'll take a few phone calls as well. For Carl Lewis and Jeffrey Marks, and Carl is a man who is a phenomenal athlete. I think if we rated the greatest athletes of the 20th century, he would be in the top 10, and in some ratings, you were in the top 10, maybe the top 5. He is a man who dominated his sport like perhaps nobody before him. Carl Lewis, in 19 years old, he won the NCAA championship in the 100-meter dash at LSU. You have remarked, Carl, that as you developed through the years, you weren't always the main guy. In fact, far from it.
Yeah, I tell you something. I had two older brothers and a younger sister, and still to this day, I've never met a better athlete than my sister. You know, she's no question. She was phenomenal, and I was a very late bloomer growing wise. So I had these two older brothers that were successful, and I was the kid. And I always used to comment like I felt like I was the runt in the family, like you know, in the litter. And the great thing about it, I still had them as role models, and my parents still convinced me, oh, you'll be great someday. I know they were crossed their fingers, but they kept saying that. And as long as you study hard and work hard, it'll turn around. And for me, fortunately, when I started to grow, that time I spent losing and working hard and getting mechanics and technique, that benefited me later. And that's why, you know, I tell all these young kids, don't give up if you're not winning right away. You just don't know what the future is unless you quit.
How important is it for any man, white or black, Eurasian or whatever, to have a male role model?
Well, it's very important. And that role model does not always have to be your father in the home. And that's something we've heard in the past. I know First Lady or Hillary Clinton talked about it takes a village. Well, when I was growing up, every single family did not have the male female father in the house. Some was an uncle, some was a coach. But I think it's important because it guides you, helps guide you through those experiences. Right now, I have an 18-year-old, and there are so many things that he just doesn't understand. He thinks he knows, but I get it. And, of course, he says he doesn't listen, but he hears that. So I think it's important to find that role model in their life, even if it isn't a father in the home.
Would it help to have more African-American males as teachers in the schools?
Oh, I that's one of the things that I think we're missing the point, because right now, if you have everyone else explaining that experience to these young people, it's difficult because it is different being a young black boy in America than it is an Asian boy or a white boy or whatever. It's a different experience. And to be able to have someone that understands that and that can articulate that to these young people, it would be very helpful. So I tell a lot of people that's a great job to have. Both my parents were teachers, and more black men need to go into teaching.
Well, tomorrow, Carl, who is, of course, versatile in many sports. In fact, what was it? It was the Cowboys, right?
Yeah, the Cowboys tried to get you.
Cowboys
and the Bulls.
Cowboys and the Bulls.
Yeah, Cowboys and the Bulls, yeah.
They wanted you to play sports for different sports, and sometimes that works out. Didn't work out so well for Michael Jordan when he tried baseball, but you're going to try baseball tomorrow. At least one pitch.
Yeah, one pitch. And so we're going to make sure we get it all the way there. You know, no 55-footers tomorrow.
Now, let me clarify something here. We have not determined yet. We're going to have a little practice out there today.
Yeah.
And we haven't determined yet if this is going to be 60 feet, 55 feet. We'll figure that all
out.
It's supposed
to be 60 feet, but, 6 inches.
Right.
But that's it won't be short, I tell you that.
But we're really lucky because we have the help of an incredible young man who a lot of people in this community know about, one of the LSU baseball players named Rafe Rimes, who is going to work with Carl on his throw today, we think. And hopefully it'll work out real well. But the important thing, of course, it's for a cause, and it's really about awareness and reaching people and just sharing a message with them about organ donation.
You knew Wendy, didn't you?
Yes, I knew Wendy very well.
And for 14 years, she fought valiantly before succumbing to liver disease, but she had a transplant along the way, and if not for that, she would not have lived as long as she did.
Yeah, and the amazing thing about it is that it's interesting because Wendy was an amazing young woman. She had just finished college and she was starting her life. And then this transplant gave her a voice to millions of people in the world. And we really don't know what's going to give you that voice, whoever you are in the world. And after that, she's probably in the transplant world has been as influential as anyone in terms of awareness and just getting people to know the issues of organ transplantation. And who would have thought that would be Wendy Marks? And because you just never know. And that's what's so inspiring to me, because she took on that cause and said, I found my voice after she had her transplant. And then we just followed her.
Well, in 1989, Wendy, 22 years old and working in a San Francisco marketing firm, first year out of college, she's got her full life ahead. And then, boom, she's hit with hepatitis B. And that's when her valiant struggle, and really she prevailed for many years. It began, and Jeff, you were right there.
I was, and just hearing you say that kind of hit me. I think about Wendy every single day. Wendy was my little sister, my only sister, my best friend, and I will never forget standing over her bed in 1989 when she was in a coma and the doctors told me she had only 24 hours to live. Carl was with us in the hospital as well, by the way, so he's been involved right from the start, and I think that's why this issue means so much to both of us. And, you know, we were really fortunate at the time. Wendy got that donor the next day. Unfortunately, in America, 19 people a day die while waiting, and more than 118,000 people in our nation are waiting for a transplant right now. So it's an issue that needs more work. You know, Wendy got those 14 years. They were an amazing gift from the age of 22 to 36 for her. But on October 28th of 2003, I held Wendy as she took her final breath in this world. And that, of course, is a moment that I will never forget. It's the single worst experience I've ever had in my life. But right away, Carl and I decided that this was something we needed to continue working on in Wendy's name and in Wendy's honor and as a tribute to her and to her commitment to this cause. So it means so much to me to be able to keep sharing Wendy with people, and she keeps bringing good people together. I absolutely love that.
And you have created the Wendy Marks Foundation.
Right. We started that with Wendy in 1990. So Carl and Wendy and I, and what a joy that was to share her with the nation. We always loved referring to her as living, breathing, smiling proof that organ donation works. And unfortunately, we can't use those words anymore, but we do have this annual event. This is the 10th annual Wendy's Birthday Bash for Organ Donation that we're holding here in Baton Rouge this weekend. The Donor Awareness Day at Alex Box Stadium with the LSU Tigers is part of that tomorrow. And it's really just amazing that 10 years later, to see and hear and feel the way people still respond to Wendy and her message, even though she isn't here personally to deliver it, is just one of the most meaningful things in my life.
Why do you think more people are not organ donors?
Simply lack of awareness. All these years we've been working on it, and strangely enough, Carl and I were talking about this morning over coffee. It's been almost a quarter of a century now for us working on this issue. It's so much a part of our lives. And the parameters really haven't changed. It's really all about awareness. And it's our belief that if we keep reaching people, keep sharing a personal story, that's the way you reach people and have them become more aware. It's not people thinking about it and saying no. It's more that they've never really even thought about it. So our job is to keep people thinking about it.
And you say 19 people a day
in our nation die waiting for a transplant of some kind, heart, liver, lung, kidney, pancreas, whatever the case might be. People like you, people like me, through no fault of their own, they need a transplant. And they're only dying because of the shortage of donors. The doctors are there. The medical technology is there. We can change that. We must change that. And we will change that if we keep talking about it.
All right. 297-5633. We'll take a few calls for Carl Lewis and for Jeffrey Marks. Dan downtown. Good morning, Dan. You're on the air.
Good morning. Yes, in your track career, did you come across Coach Lauren Speedway, who got the LSU women's track program off the ground?
Yes, I did. I remember Coach Seagrave. He's actually still coaching. I think he lives in Atlanta now. But yes, I was involved kind of my whole career, obviously from the 80s to the 90s. So all the coaches, and I remember a lot of the athletes. Some of them, I remember Don Sowell back in those days, and so many of the different athletes I made teams with. So yes, I do.
And Seagrave ultimately coached Ben Johnson.
Yeah, he got involved with Ben, and also recently
Ben who?
See, I'm not a hater in that regard. Okay, people say, don't you dislike him? I'm like, no, I won. You know, so, but yeah, he coached him, and just recently, Dwight Phillips, long jumper that he was helping as well.
Well, since we brought up Ben, what about steroids? You didn't use them, but obviously a lot of other people did, and I would imagine if you had, you would have records that would never be broken. Why did you not use them?
Well, you know, I didn't even see it in that context. My coach was not thinking about it. And I remember a day in 19 when I was young and coming up, like back at that point, winning races, even before I could even think of taking anything like that. I was just very successful. And I understood that I had an amazing talent. You know, it's sometimes it was like almost a burden of thought saying, why are you so good? But I did understand that. And it just never came up in the conversation. And so then when we had people like Ben or something that started to take it, then I took on the chance of saying, look, we can beat them anyway, and we can prove that you don't need it. And when I remember back all those years of being that young kid that was not the best and was small and was getting eighth and ninth place, and that wasn't really a big issue. And then when I started to win, that part of me stayed inside. So why did I need to take drugs to do anything more when I've already been through the worst and the best part of competition?
Do you think most of your contemporaries did take them?
No, I still think most people do not take it. You know, but if you look at it in the numbers, let's say if five people, big time people, take it, that's 5 out of 500 sprinters in the world. But if four of those five are in the final, then that's 50%. That's the problem. It isn't the numbers game. It's the percentage of the quality of the numbers.
297-5633, HB in Denham Springs. Please be brief, HB. You're on with Jeffrey and Carl.
Good morning. Gentlemen, I've been an organ donor for 40 years, and it's my understanding that being an organ donor does not conflict with any religious beliefs you may have, whether it be Catholic, Protestant, or Jewish. Is that your understanding also, so that the audience could know? Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much for bringing that up. You're absolutely correct. And when we were first learning about this issue back in the 1980s, that was so comforting and reassuring to me as we learned about that and went out to speak to people about it. Because it's one of the first questions that comes up everywhere we go, and I'm really glad it does. Because the fact is that every single major Western religion now supports and encourages organ donation. So that's a really easy answer. And it's a really easy thing and comfortable fact to share with people. So thanks for bringing it up.
Thank you, HB. 297-5633. We'll take another call or two for Carl and for Jeffrey. Carl is in Baton Rouge, not only to throw out the first pitch tomorrow at the LSU baseball game, but he is here as an ambassador and as a mover and shaker. And I guess he was there as one of the founders of the Wendy Marks Foundation. And this is all designed to help people become more aware and more active in organ donation. For those who'd like to contact the foundation independent of this weekend, what's the best way to do that, Jeff?
Well, the foundation is available through the website jeffreymarks.org, one solid word, jeffreymarks, M-A-R-X.org. Way more important than that, even here in Louisiana, one of the best organizations in the country happens to be here called LOPA, Louisiana Organ Procurement Agency, and their website is www.lopa.org. And the great thing about LOPA is they have one of the best organ donor registries in America. They were one of the first. Carl and I are very proud that we were here in 1994, and we were part of kicking that off with them. We did a game in the Superdome, you probably remember, Jim, called Dribbling for Donors with basketball with Dale Brown at the time. And LOPA used that event to kick off their organ donor registry. So go to LOPA.org. You can learn more about it, and you can even register right there.
Bo in the Garden District. Good morning, Bo. You're on WRKF with Carl Lewis and Jeffrey Marks.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Jeff. And good morning, Carl. How are y'all?
Good morning.
Great. Hey, Jeff, you know, you and I are great friends. Carl, you're a huge hero of mine. I just wanted to tell you I had an interesting encounter this week. I found out that someone who works in my office, her son was tragically killed in a car wreck, but about 6 years ago, but five different people are now living because of him being an organ donor, and that was through much of the work of LOPA, and you know, what you've done on the field and on the track was amazing, but what y'all are doing now is way, way better.
Well, thank you, and you bring up an amazing point, and gosh, I feel bad that I hadn't even talked about this yet. The heroic choices that families make. And something that is so important to us is to celebrate organ donors and their families. We never had a chance to meet Wendy's donor family. She wrote them an amazing letter. I'll never forget it. But it just wasn't their choice, and we fully respect that for the families to ever meet. But there's not a day that went by in Wendy's life that she did not think about that family. And it's this incredible equation, Jim, because we have to remember that on one side of it, the transplant recipient side, there's all this celebration over the gift of life. And unfortunately, so often, that comes from a tragic situation on the other end, which is the loss of life. Although now we have more and more living donors as well for kidneys and liver, partial liver transplants. So it does work both ways. But boy, we always want to hug and celebrate and honor and cherish those donors and their donor family members.
Two remarkable gentlemen, Jeffrey Marks and Carl Lewis of the International Olympic Committee, named Carl its Sportsman of the Century. He now serves as a Goodwill Ambassador of the United Nations. Five Olympic teams, 35 years old the last time, right?
That's right.
Do you miss it?
No. The great thing about it is that I did everything possible. And early in my career, I was mainly a long jumper. And I try to always tell people, they say fastest man in the world. And I decided I wanted to try to go for four in the Olympics. And the great thing about that decision was that, number one, I never held the world record in the outdoor long jump. The indoor I still have. But I did get to four, thank goodness. And when I finished my career, there were no thoughts in my mind of I wish I had. It was always I did everything. I felt like I could have gotten the long jump record, but Mike Powell did a phenomenal job to have it. But when I left, I was ready. And I missed the camaraderie of my teammates. But we're still friends, so I can still do that. But the other part of it, it's okay.
Well, thanks for coming this way. Always good to see Carl Lewis in Baton Rouge. Really an outstanding gentleman who has represented America quite well all over the planet. Thank you, Carl. Thank you, Jeffrey. See you soon, too.
Jim, thank you. I hope this community knows what a gift they have in Jim Angster. So thank you very much. Always good to see you.
Thank you. Glad to always be back.
And we'll return Monday. Until then, for Kevin Gallagher, stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Angster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Angster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.